Eric, and I thank the committee for inviting me to come here and talk. I'm going to be talking about oil seeds today, oil seed cropping systems, both present cropping systems, which in the United States, and sticking in the United States, is primarily soybean, and I'm going to be talking about potential future oil seed systems for biofuels purposes. And if I can get this to switch, there we go. So just an outline of what I want to try to cover over this 30 minutes is just briefly talking about some of the challenges of meeting the mandated biofuel goals. Talk about oil seeds as biofuel feedstock, both the present status and what is predicted for the future. Before I start talking about current oil seed production, some of the pros and cons of that. Again, we're primarily talking soybean here in the U.S. With a few minor oil seed crops grown. And then most of you who know me know that I work on new and alternative oil seed crops. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about second generation or dedicated oil seed biofuel crops and bioproduct crops, some of the pros and cons there, and challenges of integrating those into current cropping systems, because we're not trying to displace, and we definitely don't want to displace, things like corn and soybean, of course. That would be shooting ourselves in the foot. But how can we integrate some of these crops into our present systems? Well, where are we going? First of all, obviously, there's a big campaign that's been going on for some time now to replace petroleum for renewables, and we're here because of energy. But also, think of it in terms of replacing petrochemicals for industrial manufacturing, and a lot of that work, particularly with oilseed crops, has been going on for quite some time. Now, I've got to talk a little bit about that. Back in 07, of course, there was the Energy and Independent Security Act, which mandated the production and use of 36 billion gallons of liquid biofuels by 2022. 15 billion of that is capped as corn, grain, ethanol, or 57 billion liters. And then the remaining 21 billion gallons is proposed to be made up of advanced biofuels, mostly cellulosic fuels, but as I'll talk about, I think oil seeds can play a very important role in that as well. So how do we get there? Well, first of all, you know, there's a lot of debate whether that this is a realistic goal or not, and I'm not here to debate that. I think it's definitely a worthy goal to shoot for. But what we have to be really careful about it, and we've already heard it throughout, with yesterday's discussion, the symposium here, you're going to hear a lot about this. We have to be very careful how we do this so we don't jeopardize food security, and particularly environment as well. We've already heard population isn't decreasing. It's predicted to go up to 9 billion by 2050. We've got climate change to deal with. That's what we're trying to mitigate with some of these biofuels. We have to be very careful that in the process of doing that, we don't create new problems. The food versus fuel debate's right at the center of that. And I really think that we're at a crossroads here. If we continue down this path of bioenergy and biofuels, we have to be very careful that we don't perpetuate a lack of diversity by placing more pressure on food use crops to now produce fuel as well as food, feed, and fiber. By doing that, you know, I think we'll perpetuate lack of diversity, which is already creating some issues, and I'm going to talk about those. But it's also a point at which we can maybe integrate some of these other dedicated biofuel crops that can help diversify cropping systems. But again, there's also the land use competition issue. If we use some of these crops, dedicated biofuel crops, we have to be careful we're not taking away land that's being used for food. Oil seeds is biofuel feedstock. Obviously, we've heard this. Biodiesel's been around a long time. The technology is very simple. Transesterification of oils, triglycerides, and free fatty acids using alcohol, methanol, and a catalyst, typically an acid or a base. Typically a base is used because it's a little more efficient. But in the process of this, there's a lot of glycerol produced, and there has to be something done with that as a byproduct. And there's also, you know, you have to neutralize the acid or base, so you've got some waste material there as well. But the important thing to point out is there are other processes that are being developed. I'm not an expert on those, but what I am familiar with is the McGuyan process. It was actually a plant built in my home state of Minnesota this past year using this process. Utilizes a metal oxide, a very inert catalyst, It's a continual flow process that creates a very minimal waste, and it's already been tested on over 40 feedstocks, so it's feedstock flexible and very successful. And of course, there are other fuels that vegetable oils are well suited for. Aircraft fuel, of course, and we've heard about gasoline drop-ins. And we may want to think, you know, in terms of oil seeds in targeting one of these markets. And right now, actually, aircraft fuel is being targeted. I'll talk a little bit about that later. And biodiesel is very efficient. You take the same amount of biodiesel compared to the same amount of number two petrodiesel, produces 88% of the amount of energy. And there's typically more energy return than ethanol. And studies have shown that biodiesel, soy biodiesel compared to corn grain ethanol is more energy return, energy efficient, and can be produced with a lower carbon footprint as well. But feedstock cost, of course, is very, that's most of the operating cost. And right now, at the present petroleum cost, and for instance, what soybean oil and soybean is worth, it's a hard go. So feedstock is very important. If we can produce cheaper alternatives, low input alternatives, we can bring that down. So soybean, of course, is the primary feedstock for biodiesel in the United States. There are some other fats and oils used, but it's very minuscule compared to the amount of soybean that's used. And we use soybean by virtue of the amount that we produce. Soybean has been bred and developed for food uses, primarily a source of protein. With that, the oil has come along with it. And by virtue of the amount we produce enough oil that we actually have excess, and some of that can be used for biodiesel without affecting food prices all that much. And other food use oil seeds like sunflower, canola, but soybean as well, the oil has a higher value for food uses and even other industrial uses. So that's another reason why it's kind of a hard go economically. Nevertheless, production jumped considerably between 2004 and 2008 from 0.1 to 2.7 billion liters of biodiesel produced. And the interesting thing is the capacity for producing diesel in the United biodiesel in the U.S. still far exceeds that which we actually produce. And this is just to show here. During that time that biodiesel increased, biodiesel production increased so much, soybean production didn't, basically. Actually, it went down in 2007. That's because corn futures were up. More production went into corn, so direct one-to-one correlation there. There was a drop in soybean acres. But production went up. It went up primarily because we simply used more soybean oil for producing biodiesel during that time. Not that we grew anymore. As a fuel perspective, here in the U.S., we use about 229 billion liters per year of petrodiesel. That is both transportation and heating oil diesel. So even if we took all the soybean oil that we currently produce, which is around 10 billion liters per year, and converted that to biodiesel, assuming a one-to-one conversion, it'd only be about 4% of our diesel use. So pardon the pun, but just a drop in the bucket. And furthermore, this comes from the FAO, it's predicted the color line here, bar, shows what's predicted for the U.S., and production isn't predicted to increase, in fact, stay about the same or even go down a little bit for biodiesel, whereas other countries, for instance, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Brazil are predicted to increase. But this is biodiesel. If we look at total field crop acres, this is primarily row crop acres that are grown in the U.S. Over the past two decades, it hasn't changed too much. It's bebopped around a little bit between 320 and 330 million acres. Of that, about 20 to 26% is composed of all oilseed crops, which is the green line that I have shown there. And of course, soybean is most of that, which is shown by the blue line underneath there. And only about the other oilseed crops, which are primarily canola and sunflower, there is a little bit of flax and safflower and mustard grown, but that only makes up about 3 to 5 million acres. For soybean, of course, that's mostly grown in the Corn Belt region along the Mississippi River Valley there and a little bit out east. When we're talking all other oilseed crops, North Dakota is the leading producer of all other minor oilseed crops. Sunflower, there is some grown out, grown throughout the Great Plains. Canola, across the northern U.S. and even down in Oklahoma and Texas, they grow some food-grade canola as well as high uric acid oilseed rape. But these areas are important to keep in mind because some of these dedicated oilseed biofuel crops that I'll be talking about, these are areas where potentially they can be grown, and some already are, by the way. Also, it's not predicted, this USDA agricultural projection for major crops, corn, wheat, and soybean, which make up the bulk of those field crop acres, are not predicted to change much over the next 8 years. So it does beg the question, how can we increase, or can we even increase, oil for biofuels to meet the mandated goals? And these are just some of the ways. This isn't an exhaustive list, but these are some of the ways that I can see of that happening. Diverting more commodity oils to biodiesel, such as soy, probably not likely to occur, at least in the present future, because of food prices, affecting food prices. And some of those oils have higher use for even other industrial purposes, for making bioproducts rather than biodiesel. There's diverting more area to oil seeds, both highly and perhaps less productive lands. Some of these dedicated oil seed crops that I'm going to be talking about for biofuels do have lower input requirements, so they perhaps could be grown on more marginal lands than, say, in the Corn Belt region. And then there's, of course, increasing seed yield oil content and manipulating fatty acid profiles, and a lot of that has been going on and is ongoing. And actually, there's some interesting things being done with manipulating fatty acid profiles for specific fuels and bioproduct uses in commodity crops. And then, of course, there's integrating second-generation or dedicated oilseed biofuel crops into current cropping systems to help diversify systems. We've heard about diversity. Potentially used on less productive land. And as I'll talk about a little bit later, even used in double cropping situations on more highly productive lands, such as in the Corn Belt. And, of course, there's balance. Use a little bit of everything. Well, currently, when we're talking current cropping system, we're primarily talking about soybeans when we're talking oilseed crops here in the United States. And, of course, billions of dollars have been spent on research and development of soybean, and sunflower and canola are seeing more and more of their fair share of research dollars as well. And, of course, that's primarily for food uses. Soybean is number one protein source in the world. That's what it's primarily been bred for. Oil has come along with that. With an increase in yield, increase in protein, oil has come along with that. Also, because of the development that's gone on, we have a wider germplasm base that can fill the need of certain oil types, soil types, and climates. Okay. And because of the technology that we have and knowledge for growing these crops and management practices, they're much easier to manage, much easier for farmers to manage. Roundup Ready soybeans are obviously a good example of that. Soybean has the added advantage of being a legume, fixes its own nitrogen, even puts some back in the soil. And these crops are highly subsidized. Commodity crops are highly subsidized. It's easy for farmers to get crop insurance, and in today's economics and policies, it just takes more of the risk out of it for them and makes it easier for them to produce. And more profitable, of course, too. But there are some issues with current systems. Rising input costs. For instance, this is a comparison. This comes from NASS, a comparison between 2002 and 2007. Average per farm expense went up 68% during that 5 years. Fertilizers, chemicals, that's pesticides and so on, up 122%. Seeds and plants up 79%. That keeps continuing to rise. And, of course, fuels and oils, we know what's happened there. They've gone up considerably. Intensive management to keep yields high has created situations of overuse of inputs in certain instances, which have created issues with soil, air, and water quality. Many have heard about the hypoxia issue in the Gulf, potentially from leakage of ag chemicals into waterways that have reached their way to the Gulf and created a dead zone there. And, of course, climate change. And agriculture can play a big role in that, in either helping to mitigate, for instance, greenhouse gas emissions, or if not properly managed, it can be a source. So we have to be very careful there. And, of course, a lot of this stems from the lack of agricultural diversity, and this is something I constantly push. You know, when we're up in the Corn Belt region, it's corn and soybeans. Very little other crops are rotated. And you're seeing a lot of monocropping of corn and soybean going on, which has caused a greater incidence of pests and diseases, which requires more chemicals to control. And then we're right back up to the top of overuse of inputs. We have to be very careful. There's also some other general oil seed issues. Soybeans, for instance, have been implicated in soil, exacerbating soil erosion. There have been studies that show that. Oil seeds in general don't return a lot of biomass to the soil. They tend to have a lower carbon to nitrogen ratio, which causes them to degrade down quicker. Also, pathogen and pests are a huge issue that cause millions of dollars in crop losses every year. Soybean, we have Asian rust, which is a big issue, cyst nematode, soybean aphid, and canola has its issues too, with blackleg and white mold. Canola requires relatively high nitrogen fertilization to maintain high yield, and soybean and sunflower have relatively high water uses. We've heard about how important water use is. Second generation, we're going to take some time now to talk about dedicated oilseed biofuel crops, or second generation biofuel crops. In common, they tend to be less genetically refined because less research and development has gone on there. But they do tend to have in common that they have high seed oil contents. Some of these tend to have lower input requirements to maintain yields. And many that I'll mention are mustard species that come from the Brassicaceae family. The ones that have lower input needs could be targeted for more marginal, less productive lands. But regional specificity, at least in the near term, is going to be very important because of the lack of germplasm base. So there are going to be certain species that just grow better in certain areas, much like our biomass crops. Some of these, this isn't an exhaustive list either, but these are some that I'll mention. Mustard species, Lescarella, Crambi, Brassica gentia, brown or Indian mustard, Lapsiarvans, pennycress, which is still a weed but shows very good potential for biofuels, and camelina are some of the mustards. Lescarella and camelina both have very good drought tolerance. In fact, Lescarella has been growing in the southwest United States, southwest part of the United States, and does very well down there. Camelina is also very cold tolerant, and there are both winter and spring types. I'll talk more about that here in just a minute. Kufiya is an interesting one. This produces mainly medium and small chain fatty acids, which you probably know are imported in the United States in the form of coconut and palm kernel oil. So it could serve as a domestic source for medium chain fatty acids. We've heard a lot about Jatropha. Probably not too practical for the United States. It's a tropical tree or shrub. It's very sensitive to cold, and it's hard to get established. So it's probably not practical for the U.S., but other regions certainly has good possibilities. Some of the advantages of these dedicated biofuel crops, number one, they're being developed primarily for industrial uses, not food uses. So there isn't a direct competition there. They can help to diversify cropping systems. There's evidence showing that they help break up pest and pathogen cycles. Some of the mustards, there's good research evidence to show that they can help suppress weeds, control weeds. Glucosinolates from mustards have been implicated as a biofumigant in the soil, which has positive implications. And ecosystem services is something to keep in mind as well. Particularly some of these mustard species and the ones that can be grown as winter annuals are flowering at times that other crops or other plants aren't. So they provide more habitat for pollinators and a larger window of opportunities for pollinators to work. And the pollinators help fertilize those mustards as well to improve yields. So it's a synergistic benefit. And they can also provide habitat for beneficial predatory-type insects that prey on insects we don't want. Value-addedness is something to keep in mind, too. I hear this more and more at meetings I've been to. Processors will talk about that we should be targeting some of the novel and unique fatty acids of some of these oilseed crops for certain bioproducts that have greater value and think of the fuel as a byproduct. And this isn't an exhaustive list either, but some that I'll mention are, for instance, hydroxylated fatty acids like lescarellic acid, ricinoleic acid, from Lesquerella and castor bean, which impart high lubricity on greases and coatings, have good value there, and also for adding value to biodiesel from the standpoint of higher lubricity. Conjugated fatty acids, you're going to hear more about this in the future, can replace volatile organic compounds in fuels and a myriad of other chemistries as well. Medium chain fatty acids like that produced by TUFIA, such as capric and wauric, have great value in many different specialty chemicals, particularly personal care products, and have been shown to produce an excellent jet fuel as well. That's what's shown down here. This is a GC comparison, but it's actually a blend of coconut and TUFIA oil where the triglycerides are simply cleaved from the glycerol backbone to create these paraffins. And compared to that of JPA jet fuel, you can see the peaks are represented quite well in this blend of coconut and TUFIA. And TUFIA, by the way, can be produced in temperate climates and doesn't displace orangutans. this is just often people want to know, well, what do some of these crops yield in terms of oil per area on an area basis? And, of course, soybean and canola, which are much more genetically refined, typically produce much higher seed yields. Soybean, however, isn't known for its high oil content, only about averages about 19%. This is average range. These aren't necessarily the highest or lowest values. canola, of course, has a high oil content and does quite well. But some of these dedicated oilseed crops, because they generally have high oil contents, less genetically refined, so the seed yields vary more, but they can compete very well, or outcompete, I should say, soybean, in terms of oil produced per area. Pennycress is one that shows very good potential. It's still a weed, although there are some people that are starting to work on its development now. It creates a very good biodiesel product. I threw microalgae in here as well because, you know, that's been touted. It obviously has very good potential, but economically and logistically, we're still a ways out there yet. Well, how can we integrate some of these dedicated biofuel crops into current cropping systems without affecting or sacrificing food production? And I don't have enough time to talk about all the different ways, but one I do want to talk about is potentially double cropping on highly productive lands. Double cropping is something that has been successful in the South and Mid-South, with mixed results in the northern plains and Midwest, primarily because of a shorter growing season. But oftentimes what is done is to use a winter crop, a winter cereal. Winter wheat has been a good one, followed by soybean, a relatively short season food crop, or even a forage crop. And another way of doing this is relay cropping, too, which has also worked well in the South, using winter wheat, and then interseeding soybean early in the spring so that you're overlapping growing cycles. With some of those dedicated oilseed biofuel crops, and I'll talk about camelina specifically, some of those can be grown as winter annuals. As I mentioned, camelina is one, and actually I and some of my colleagues have been working with this. And even as far north as we are in Minnesota, winter camelina can be harvested early enough to allow successful double cropping of soybean, sunflower, and millet. In fact, this past summer, we began experimenting with relay cropping, and this shows very good success as well. We produced soybean yields that average 2,300 gigs per hectare, which is pretty good. And the camelina averaged about just a little less than 1,400 gigs per hectare. So when you start adding the yields of both crops up, economically, the economics are looking very favorable for that double cropping system. And of course, there are others who are working on double cropping biomass crops as well with some success there. But there are, of course, some issues with double cropping, while both pros and cons. Growing a winter crop, of course, you have you have winter cover crop, which can help prevent erosion, take up excess nitrogen and phosphorus, partially reduces the food and fuel debate because now you're producing a dedicated fuel crop as well as a food crop, and can be an added source of income to growers. Like I said, the economics of the double crop system that we've been working with, camelina and soybean, looks very favorable. But there are some issues. When you're growing two crops, obviously you tend to use more water. fertilizer, and compaction, you have to be careful of because you're running over the field more. But the good thing is with some of these low-input dedicated crops, we can somewhat mitigate the water use and fertility, and with controlled trafficking, we can deal with the compaction as well. So there are some ways of mitigating and dealing with those issues. The double crop system that we've been working with, camelina and soybean, also looks very favorable from the standpoint of amount of oil and hence energy that's produced. This is an average over a two-year period, and we produced about twice as much oil in the double crop system as we did with monocrop soybean over that same period of time. Some of the challenges of commercial production of these crops, number one is simply a lack of knowledge. There's more research that needs to be done, particularly on management practices, pest control, weed control is always a biggie, fertility. Where do they fit in the crop sequence, and are there rotational effects? These are some things that need to be researched. We've already heard environmental limitations, resource use, particularly water use, temperature sensitivity, and we can throw radiation use efficiency and nitrogen efficiency in there as well. Also limited germplasm base, and oftentimes, especially when you have a species that isn't far removed from its weedy relatives, seed shattering and indeterminacy can be issues. So these are some things that need to be researched and breeders need to work out. Other challenges, limited research and development, funding for research and development. Industry has a big interest in some of these crops, but they're not willing to make that long-term commitment. Lack of economic incentive and risk needs to be reduced for the farmer. He needs to be able to get insurance for these, crop insurance for growing these. But that is starting to change. It's going to take a change in ag policy. So in summary, I and I think many others too believe that oil seeds can play an important role in feedstock for advanced biofuels. But like these other biofuel feedstocks that we're going to be talking about in this symposium, we have to be very careful of how it's managed so that we don't create new problems. And we don't want to perpetuate a lack of diversity in our cropping systems. Dedicated oilseed crops, I believe, can really play an important role here as low input feedstock for helping to diversify ag systems. But it's going to take policy change. And that needs to be science-based. And I'll stop there because it's not always science-based. But with that, if I have any time for questions, I'll... Yeah, Long Beach population, too. When I heard this conference was going to be in Long Beach, I got all excited. I was like, oh, that's 20 miles down the road from where I'm at. And it turns out it's in California. I don't know if we're going to... Them back there? Around 50 to 60 pounds per acre. And it does pretty well on that. It doesn't seem to have real high nitrogen. But, you know, like Jeff was talking about, you can't grow these crops without anything. You know, you're not going to get something for nothing. You know, Jatropha has been touted as a miracle crop that'll, you know, produce buku tons of oil, you know, without any water and hardly any fertilizer. Well, you know, don't believe that. These crops do need fertilizer and they do need water. One of the things that we're closely monitoring too is the water use of camelina, especially in a study that we have going on right now with double cropping. There is some work going on in academia right now. I've been sending out a lot of seed to various breeders. I know there's one in the University of Nebraska system that's out in an experiment station. He's working on camelina. There's some private industry work going on with camelina. I don't know if you maybe know about that. Sustainable oils. They're doing a little bit of breeding. It's not a real, you know, in-depth breeding program. Some of these others, Penny Press, there's a breeder at Western Illinois University who's starting to do some work with it, and he's actually come up with some lines. Seed dormancy has been an issue there, but he seems to have come up with germplasm that doesn't have any seed dormancy. So there is a little bit of breeding work that's starting to take place out there. We're planting right after taking the winter camelina off. It's around between the 20th and 28th of June. And the relay, we relayed that in. This was the first year that we experimented with that. We were relaying it in late April, about April 20th, I think is when that was put in. Now, we did have an exceptional year this past year. The monocrop soybean did quite well as also. Winter, it prefers to be planted a little bit later. We're planting late September to early October is the best. Yeah. It's not like winter wheat, where earlier would be better. It comes up really fast. I mean, we've got a good rosette formed by mid-October. Yep. Rosettes pretty well. And yeah, planting any earlier than that, we seem to get less survival. But it seems to be more related to moisture than it is cold. We find that wherever we have standing water, and when you're in Minnesota and have a lot of snowpack, that's not hard to find early in the spring, that seems to be more detrimental than freezing. Is that it? Thank you.